Welcome to the podcast series, Blindingly Obvious. My name is Minnie Baragwanath, and this series is based on my book by the same name. Blindingly Obvious is my story. It is a candid and deeply personal story about my life and work as a blind woman, social entrepreneur, and innovator. I wrote it in order to share my experience of blindness with others, and in the hope that it might raise awareness and invite others to actively create a more accessible future, one that is full of possibility. A wonderful voiceover artist and now friend of mine, Romy Hooper, has narrated my full book, all 24 chapters. I do so hope you enjoy listening. It is an absolute pleasure to be able to share it with you.
14. Innovation Unleashed. It was extremely fortunate that one of the very last programs Shirley and I filmed together in the early 2000s for the Inside Out television series was about the wonderful Mark Bagshaw. Mark was Australian and was invited to New Zealand by my friend Todd Fernie and as a guest of AUT. Mark was the head of marketing for IBM Australasia at the time. He was a very successful businessman and he was also tetraplegic. Mark was the most extraordinary public speaker. At a special event, he shared with us his unique worldview and philosophy on accessibility. Hearing Mark speak and being exposed to his way of thinking about access was utterly life-changing for me. It set me on a path that, in many ways, I am still on to this very day. That night, Mark started by sharing his own story with us. As a teenager, he had been showing off in front of some girls at the beach in Sydney when he dived into the sea. He had misjudged the depth of the water and broken his back and become tetraplegic. Literally overnight, he went from being this tall, able-bodied, athletic young man who was a top student and also a budding concert pianist to being classified as disabled and a second-class citizen, reliant on considerable support to go about his daily life as a wheelchair user. For Mark, the contrast with his life before he became disabled was stark. And he had an amazing ability to describe and make accessible the disabling experience for others. One minute, he had every opportunity in front of him. The next, he was faced with barrier after barrier after barrier. He was, of course, still the same person, but how the world saw him and classified him had forever changed. He talked about the challenge of now finding work as a young man. He talked about the fact that, more often than not, he could not get into various buildings to attend the actual job interview, because he literally could not get in the front door or find a taxi that could take him and his wheelchair to the interview on time. He talked about the fact that if, indeed, he did get in the front door and into the interview room, he was often met with such prejudice and disbelief when the interviewer saw a young tetraplegic man that he knew instantly that he could never get the job. It wouldn't be due to his ability or intelligence, but to social myths, stereotypes, and the devaluing of disabled people. As he experienced the physical and attitudinal barriers from potential employers, month after month after month, Mark's confidence took a massive hit. Of course it did. The disabling effects of these cumulative barriers on his self-worth, his self-esteem, and his mental health were devastating. How on earth does someone keep bouncing back time and time again? How on earth does a young person looking for work keep resilient and keep on believing in themselves? Eventually, Mark did ultimately find work with IBM, and that became a lifelong career for him. The thing that set him apart was that while he had strong social values and lived with the direct effects of disability, he now also had deep experience of the corporate world and could see the world, and most importantly, accessibility, from a different point of view, a private sector point of view. Mark was also an extraordinary marketer and storyteller. He introduced me and everyone else in the room that night to an entirely new and very simple framework, one that could be distilled down to three key pillars. In Mark's mind, and as a result of his direct life experience, these pillars are what are needed if we are to stand any chance of creating a truly equitable and accessible society. These are the physical or environmental, the social and the personal pillars. 1. The physical. For true access to occur, all physical and tangible things we can touch, feel, and see need to be made accessible. That includes buildings, websites, documents, meetings, etc. For example, physical access in this way includes someone using a wheelchair being able to access a building, as well as a deaf person having access to a sign language interpreter at a doctor's appointment, or a blind person having the correct assistive computer technology to do their job. 2. The social. True access in this context means ensuring that our values, attitudes, and beliefs as a society are accessible. In other words, do we fundamentally believe that someone who uses a wheelchair or who is deaf or blind can work? Do we fundamentally believe that access citizens have value to contribute to our world? Do we fundamentally believe that access citizens are equal? 3. The personal. True access in this context means ensuring that the person, the individual with disability or access needs, feels whole, valued, and connected to the world. It is very hard for someone to feel this way if they are regularly encountering the disabling effects of both the physical and the social environments. How does a young person looking for work keep feeling positive and of value if each time they rock up to a job interview they cannot access the building? Or if they finally can after the 20th time, the shocked faces of the interview panel say it all when they see the young person in a wheelchair enter the room. The magic, according to Mark, is to achieve a society that both embodies and at all times pays attention to these elements simultaneously. The other aspect to Mark's accessibility blueprint was his belief that in order to achieve true access, we needed not only government but also private business, as well as community organizations, to embrace his three pillars approach to accessibility. He proposed a true cross-sector strategy. He fundamentally challenged the unspoken concept that improving access and equity was the exclusive domain of government agencies, usually welfare, and of under-resourced charitable disability organisations, such as the BLVNZ or CCS or IHC. Mark also talked about disabled people as customers of products and services, people who would be willing to pay for things that could enrich and enhance their lives. He reframed disabled people away from just being recipients of welfare to being consumers of products and services and a vital part of the economy. I soon got to experience the impact of Mark's thinking and the power of the private sector at first hand. As Mark and I became great friends, I went and stayed with him at his incredible contemporary harbourside home in Sydney. This was the first time I had seen such a beautiful apartment, decked out in incredible technology that directly enabled Mark to live a great life. This is when I saw what technology and good design, and yes, money, could achieve to advance the lives of disabled people. Everything that could be automated in the house was automated. His lights, his curtains, his stereo, etc., were all automated. Remember, this is well before Amazon's Alexa that many of us have in our homes today. Mark also had the most incredible computer setup in his home office. So I witnessed at first hand the power and importance of technology when designed well, and the importance of private sector businesses such as IBM in playing a leading role in design and innovation. Mark and his life were set up for success. It felt so obvious. Mark was so right. His entire approach just made sense. And I had seen what was possible when this model worked well. I had witnessed an example of a successful, contemporary access citizen living a great life in the heart of Sydney. He had lifted the bar and, through his model, was now marketing access to the world. This was not an approach that relied on human rights language or political advocacy. It relied on smart, compelling storytelling, economics, and the language of investment, as well as the power of great innovation and design to communicate what was possible. Hearing Mark speak at AUT had felt like an epiphany. All of a sudden, every fibre of my being just knew he was right. I felt sure we now had the answer to accessibility. Aha! I had a blueprint, or a roadmap, at last. Now I wanted to try out this theory of change for real in my new job with the council. However, this was not straightforward, as I was soon to discover. Through the adoption and application of this model and the theory of what was possible, I was now challenging a vast array of other taboos and no-go zones. In particular, I was challenging some of the deeply entrenched beliefs and values held within the world of community development. I had not realized that engaging with the private sector was so frowned upon. I might as well have been engaging with the devil. And on the other side, many in the private sector looked down on the community sector as disorganized and chaotic. The very early 2000s was a time in Aotearoa when each sector had a set role and was expected to stay within certain parameters. The concept of social enterprise or corporate responsibility was not highly visible at this time in Aotearoa. That is not to say it was not happening, definitely under other names, but it certainly did not have the visibility and the understanding it has today. The work we were going to initiate in the world of access was not only pioneering new ways of advancing accessibility, we were also developing new ways to embrace both community and economic development, as well as the public, community, and the private sectors as seamlessly as possible. One of the most gorgeous people I know, and someone who was spearheading the adoption of corporate social responsibility in Aotearoa at this time, was an amazing woman called Jude Mannion. We first met at an Auckland tennis match one summer, when the Blind Foundation invited a number of their members to come and watch the game. A strange idea in some ways. As I sat in the stand, unable to watch but listening intently to the match, this fabulous woman, Jude, started to provide the most hilarious running commentary for me, mostly focused on the physical attributes of each player, how good-looking they were, what they were wearing, and so on, as well, of course, as how well they played. This is still one of the best examples of audio description I have ever heard. Once the match finished, a group of us went to a well-known restaurant on Ponsonby Road called Prego for dinner. We had a hysterical time. And from that point onwards, Jude and I became great friends. She had set up a fabulous organization called the Robin Hood Foundation, the idea being that the rich needed to give to the poor. It was one of the first, if not the first, organization of its kind to really expect, or perhaps demand, that corporate New Zealand start to step up and really invest in community in more meaningful ways. The reason Jude was listened to was that she had a huge amount of experience working in the corporate world. She had for years held a senior role at Elizabeth Arden, where she'd been based mostly overseas. She had produced a very influential and engaging document at the time called Do Good and Do Gooder, about the importance of corporate social responsibility. Now, while that is not the language we would use today, at the time it was quite provocative. It was also supported by some amazing stats and facts that another soon-to-be lifelong friend, Nick Jones, provided. It was very robust and deeply compelling. I loved it, and I loved Jude's positive, professional, and fun approach. She had a massive influence on me and my work. Jude also constantly challenged me to look for work outside of council. She feared, quite rightly as it turned out, that I would be squashed and unable to achieve my aspirations if I stayed there. She was such a wonderful champion and pioneer. My disability advisor role was located in the Community Development Department within Council, and many in this department felt a deep distrust of the private sector. Perhaps growing up with a combination of social change activists, as well as entrepreneurs and business owners, I could never see one as good and the other as bad. It just seemed absurd to me to be so black and white about this. In the same way, I have never been able to say left wing is good and right wing is bad. I just think things are more complex than this. I feel that many of these labels are not often terribly useful, or they can create an us and them mentality that is highly destructive. I've always been interested in the spaces in between, rather than in boxes or categories. And it turns out that this is where most real social innovation tends to occur, in the spaces in between existing realities or frames for seeing the world. It is the space artists and thinkers also inhabit, seeing connections between things or as the result of combining two unlikely elements to create something entirely new. Funnily enough, I guess this is also actually how I see the world as a stargazer. I do not see what is directly in front of me, the obvious. I always see what is around the edges, in the periphery, the things others may not be paying attention to, as they are busy looking straight ahead. There was another very simple reason why it also made sense to me to engage with the private sector. On an entirely practical note, as both Mark and Jude had shown me, there was more money in the private sector than in community development, and my $5,000 was going to achieve very little on its own. It simply made practical sense to find a way to attract greater resource to the access space. It was the responsible thing to do, as much as anything else. In much the same way as I never wanted personally to be dependent on the state for my financial well-being, I felt the same way about the access movement. I never wanted access advancement to be dependent on the whim of the state for our success. This just felt too risky and deeply flawed. Absolutely, the government has a critical leadership role to play, but so do all parts of our society and economy. We desperately needed, and in fact still need, a fresh way of enabling, activating, and nurturing empowered social change in the area of access. Fortunately, there were a couple of innovative companies that I encountered around this time, whose approach to business and social change exemplified how it was in fact possible to do social good and also turn over a healthy income. They were proof of concept for me. One of the most inspiring businesses I have ever encountered was called Pulse Data, based in Christchurch. To me, they exemplified how business and social change could not only coexist, but could be absolutely transformative. Pulse Data, later to become Humanware, was one of the global leaders in accessible tech for blind people in the early 2000s. It was an incredible and progressive company for several reasons. Not only did they design and make world-leading accessible tech for blind people, it was also a deliberate part of their business strategy to employ blind people as subject matter experts to design and make the technology. How progressive and insightful. For 3 years running, they were the top technology export company in New Zealand. Although today they are no longer based in New Zealand, their pioneering model is still one of the most forward-thinking, even 20 years on. Another incredible example where I witnessed the power of world-class design, enterprise, and social change drivers coming together to create something remarkable was Lomac, or the light-operated machine and keyboard. A local entrepreneur, Chris Mulcair, came across a concept that an amazing man had created literally in his garage. Then, recognizing its potential, he invited world-class industrial designer, Peter Haythornthwaite, to make it beautiful, which he certainly did. Lomac was unique. Instead of the standard rectangular QWERTY keyboard, the Lomac letters and numbers were situated in a circle, enabling the user to select the letter or digit they wanted via a head pointer. It was especially designed to enable people who could not use their hands or voice to use a computer. Lomac won the Top Industrial Design Award that same year. Not only did the private sector have a unique ability to invest additional resource into the access space, but it was full of designers, innovators, and entrepreneurs, all of whom had so much to offer in the way of access innovation. In an attempt to package up this type of approach to accessibility social change, to embody Mark's philosophy, and to showcase just what was possible when working across sectors, our Disability Issues Advisory Group and I created a one-of-a-kind showcase event called Innovation Unleashed. We invited guests and speakers from government, the private sector, and the community to witness and hear firsthand from innovative designers and entrepreneurs who were creating world-changing access innovation. Our project team had sent out the most extraordinary invitations to our guests, as we wanted something that would really get people's attention. By now, I was fully aware that if we had just sent off a standard email and said to people, "We're having a disability event," The majority of people would have imagined that it was another dour, bleak, unattractive community development presentation in a bland grey room somewhere. We simply would not have attracted the designers, the innovators, the creatives, and the entrepreneurs. We had to go out on a limb to grab the attention of those people in addition to the usual suspects. Disability had an image problem, and we had to work around this, or challenge it, or completely bypass it. The invitations to Innovation Unleashed were a paper fortune teller, the kind you made as children, where you put your forefinger and thumb in from each hand, and then open up the fortune teller to read different messages. We had filled the paper with quotes about access innovation that most people would not have ever known about. Did you know Alexander Bell was working with the deaf community when he created the telephone? Did you know the typewriter, the precursor to the standard computer keyboard we all use today, was created by an Italian man to enable his blind lover to write him letters? Did you know the father of the internet, Vint Cerf, was deaf? Did you know that vast numbers of successful entrepreneurs have dyslexia? Did you know that the top export company in New Zealand in the early 2000s made accessible technology for blind users? Did you know that the largest untapped market in the world is made up of disabled people, or access citizens, and is the same size as the population of China? We packaged up the invitations in beautiful blue boxes so they would not be crushed in the post. The cost of these stunning invitations was entirely covered by one of our many new, amazing corporate partners. Instead of sending a note of appreciation or celebrating the achievement, the senior executive who I mentioned earlier now sent another scathing email to my manager, directly questioning how Minnie could have afforded to create such an event on her budget, and was she wasting ratepayer money? I was now sadly realizing that on the one hand, I could not get my budget increased in order to be more effective. And on the other hand, I was being repeatedly slapped over the wrists if I dared step outside my lane and attract more money to the advancement of access. No wonder I was ultimately drawn to the freedom of entrepreneurship and innovation. By now, I was becoming acutely aware of a particular paradox in the world of access. This paradox reflected two seemingly opposing truths that were both equally real or true. On the one hand, I knew full well the terrible statistics about access citizens having poor health, education, and financial outcomes. And on the other hand, I now knew that access citizens were often amongst the most enterprising, innovative, and creative people on the planet. We had so much to contribute to the world if the disabling forces, the physical, social, and personal, could just get out of the way. This reality sat awkwardly with me at this time. I did not know how to reconcile this reality that Mark had helped me to see so clearly. And this was not just true in theory or for others. I was experiencing this tension or this paradox directly myself, in both my personal and my professional life. On the one hand, I felt increasingly that anything was possible with the right support, investment, and perspective, that a truly accessible world could be achieved, not just for me, but for all access citizens in Aotearoa, and in fact globally too. And yet on the other hand, I was still suffering the daily effects of profound disablement in my personal and professional life. Soon this tension, this paradox, would come to a head. All too soon, I would have to make a horrendous choice, my Sophie's choice, if you like. It was one that would determine whether I stayed trapped by a disability worldview. Or would it be one that would start to launch me into a world of possibility? I was about to be challenged to make the ultimate sacrifice in order to take this new path. Much like Abraham in the Bible, I would be required to give up something unbelievably dear and precious to me, as a sign of my unwavering commitment and my deep belief in a better future for millions of people. I was about to face one of the most defining moments in my life, one that would change me and the course of my future forever.
I do so hope you enjoyed listening to my book and podcast series, Blindingly Obvious. It has been an absolute privilege to be able to share this with you. Listen out for the next chapter, coming soon. If you would like to purchase the entire book in audio or an array of other accessible formats, including New Zealand Sign Language, or to learn more about my work, visit my website, minib.co.nz. Thank you for taking the time to listen and to be with me. See you next time. With love, Minnie B.